The invention of empathy. Yes, I can hardly believe that I found somebody writing that as the title to a piece of writing. I mean, the notion that invented empathy, or that empathy was invented at some point in human history, to be very simple, it blows my mind. So I'm now going to read you the piece where I found it. And I want to give a huge thanks, as I could do every single week, to Maria Popova, who is Brain Pickings on the internet, quite the most wonderful blogger that I know. So here's how her piece goes. It's quite long, so you might like to draw up a cup of tea or coffee, or even consume it in bite-sized chunks. Here's how she goes. Empathy, an orientation of spirit decidedly different from sympathy, has become central to our moral universe. We celebrate it as the hallmark of a noble spirit, a pillar of social justice, and the gateway to reaching our highest human potential, a centerpiece of our very humanity. And yet this conception of empathy is a little more than a century old and originated in art. It only entered the modern lexicon in the early 20th century, when it was used to describe the imaginative act of projecting oneself into a work of art in an effort to understand why art moves us. That improbable origin and its wide ripples across the popular imagination are what Rachel Corbett explores in, quote, You Must Change Your Life, the story of Rainer Maria Rilke and Auguste Rodin. That's a book or an essay. A layered and lyrical inquiry into the personal, interpersonal and cultural forces behind and around Rainer Maria Rilke. Iconic Letters to a Young Poet, a book so beloved and widely quoted in the century since its publication that it has taken on the qualities of a sacred text for secular culture. Out of its origin story, Corbett rests a larger story of, quote, how the will to create drives young artists to overcome even the most heart-hallowing of childhoods and make their work at any cost. Recounting her revelatory first encounter with the Rilke classic, a gift from her mother, who had in turn received it from a mentor as a young girl, Corbett captures the singular enchantment that this miraculous book has held for generations. And here's a long quote from Corbett. Reading it that evening was like having someone whisper to me in elongated Germanic sentences all the youthful affirmations I had been yearning to hear. Loneliness is just space expanding around you. Trust, uncertainty. Sadness is life holding you in its hands and changing you. Make solitude your home. That last bit may be a quote from Rilke. What gives the book its enduring appeal is that it crystallizes the spirit of delirious transition in which it was written. You can pick it up during any of life's upheavals, flip it open to a random page and find a consolation that feels both universal and breathed into your ear alone. End quote from Corbett. What most people don't know, Corbett points out, is that Rilke was bequeathing his poetic wisdom to the recipient of his letters, the 19-year-old cadet and aspiring poet Franz Xaver Capus. He was also channeling his own great mentor, the French sculptor Rodin, for whom Rilke worked for a number of years and whom he revered for the remainder of his life. Despite their staggering surface differences, quote, Rodin was a rational Gallic in his 60s, while Rilke was a German romantic in his 20s, end quote, Corbett writes. likening Rodin to a mountain and Rilke to the mist encircling it. The sculptor became the young poet's most significant influence, but Rodin's greatest gift to Rilke was the very thing that lends Letters to a Young Poet its abiding spiritual allure, the art of empathy. Now, you might like to take a little rest at this point, because there's quite a lot more to come. Corbett writes, quotation, "The invention of empathy corresponds to many of the climactic shifts in the art, philosophy and psychology of fin de siècle Europe, and it changed the way artists thought about their work and the way observers related to it for generations to come." End quote. Empathy may be a concept saturating today's popular lexicon so completely as to border on a meaninglessness, yet it was entirely novel and ablaze with numerous meaning in Rilke's day. Its invention is the work of two unlikely co-creators, Wilhelm Wundt, a German doctor who, quote, "accidentally forged the birth of psychology in the 1860s, end quote, and Theodor Lips, a philosopher from the following generation. In seeking to understand why art affects us so powerfully, Lips originated the then radical hypothesis that the power of its impact didn't reside in the work of art itself, but was rather synthesized by the viewer in the act of viewing. Oh my goodness, I have to quote that again, it's so good. Lips originated the then radical hypothesis that the power of its impact didn't reside in the work of art itself, but was rather synthesized by the viewer in the act of viewing. Corbett condenses the essence of his proposition and traces its combinatorial creation. Quote, "The moment a viewer recognizes a painting as beautiful, it transforms from an object into a work of art. The act of looking then becomes a creative process and the viewer becomes the artist." Oh my goodness. Lips found a name for his theory in an 1873 dissertation by a German aesthetic student named Robert Wischer. "When people project their emotions, ideas, or memories into objects, they enact a process that Wischer calls Entfühlung, literally feeling into. The British psychologist Edward Titchener translated the word into English as empathy in 1909, deriving it from the Greek empatheia, or in pathos. For Wischer, Entfühlung revealed why a work of art caused an observer to unconsciously, quote, move in and with the forms. He dubbed this bodily mimesis muscular empathy, a concept that resonated with Lips, who once attended a dance recital and felt himself, quote, striving and performing with the dancers. He also linked this idea to another somatosensory imitations like yawns and laughter, end quote. Half a century later, Mark Rothko would observe, quote, "The people who weep before my pictures are having the same religious experience I had when I painted them," end quote. He was articulating the model of creative contagion, or what Leo Tolstoy called the emotional infectiousness of art. And that Lips had formulated, Corbett writes. Now there's a long quotation. In fact, I'm going to just read this quotation and then I'm going to stop. This is Corbett. In Vienna, the young professor Sigmund Freud wrote to a friend in 1896 that he had immersed himself in the teachings of Lips, who I suspect has the clearest mind among present-day philosophical writers. That's Freud. Several years later, Freud thanked Lips for giving him, quote, "the courage and capacity to write his book Jokes and Their Relation to the Unconscious." He went on to advance Lips' research further when he made the case that empathy should be embraced by psychoanalysis as a tool for understanding patients. He urged his students to observe their patients not from a place of judgment but of empathy. They ought to recede into the background like a receptive organ and strive towards the putting of oneself in the other person's place, he said. End quote. The concept, of course, was far from novel, even if the language to contain it was. Half a century earlier, across the Atlantic, Walt Whitman had articulated the very same notion in his timeless treatise on medicine and the human spirit. I'm going to stop. It goes on and on and on. This is an astonishing piece of writing as far as I'm concerned. And I heartily recommend it. It's to be found in Brain Pickings. If you put Brain Pickings into Google, you'll find it. I get a weekly newsletter which contains all of the blog posts published during the week by Maria Popova. Anyway, I couldn't recommend it too highly. What? Oh, it's so good to find I'm no inventor, but that's my thoughts about empathy and art. My thoughts about empathy and poetry summed up in a nutshell.